Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, science, and healthcare in the news, discussion, debate, dialogue, answers to your phone calls and your emails about all of the above. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent the speakers and not necessarily the opinions of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. That kind of brings up an existential question, actually, when I think about it. Can a station or a corporation actually have an opinion? I mean, just one of them? How far does this collective thing go, anyway? Well, leaving that aside, I thought we'd start off with some interesting emails, but then I also want to invite your calls. I'll give out those numbers in just a minute. And I most importantly wanted to say that in a little bit of time, we're going to be doing a science lesson about the heart and cardiac pacing and intervals and everything you always wanted to know about that electrical wiring in the heart. So be sure you stay tuned for that. That'll be coming up about halfway through the program. Let's start with a question from Arthur in Durango, Colorado. Arthur writes, "Dear Dr. Dawn, what tests do you recommend in order to completely rule out gluten sensitivity as a cause for heart problems? Can someone not have gluten sensitivity and still have celiac disease or a similar ailment?" Arthur, I want to thank you. That's a very interesting and insightful question. So I'm going to answer the second question first by saying that celiac disease is best used as a very narrowly defined disease that is a end-stage gluten sensitivity disease. Not everyone with gluten sensitivity will go to celiac disease. And if you think of it that way and you use the terminology that way, then you can get people from both sides of the medicine spectrum, that is to say the alternative and the specialist gastroenterology side, to actually sit in the same room and not go at each other's throats. And I always think that's a good basis for a dialogue. So let's use that as a starter. Celiac disease is where when you biopsy the small intestine, you see damage to the structure. So the normally deep shag carpet appearance of the small intestine, all of those thick shag spikes representing additional surface area for physiological transformation and absorption of nutrients, all of that goes flat. You lose absorptive surface, you lose weight, and you develop lots of nutritional deficiencies because you can't absorb anything, protein, vitamins, anything. That's celiac disease. The cause of celiac disease is an autoimmune attack on the intestinal wall that is triggered by the development of antibodies. And these antibodies are themselves triggered by the fact that some of the breakdown products of gluten look just like some of the tissue surface markers, the HLA antigens that we actually use for organ transplants when they talk about tissue matching. That's the matching they're doing. I like to think of these as little barcodes on the surface of the cell. You run your sensor, immune sensor, over the barcode. It says, yes, this is a friendly, happy, personal body cell. Do not attack. Or it says, this is an invader. Attack. Now, if you happen to have an immune system that can be taught to attack itself, well, you can end up with celiac disease. So there is, to answer your first question, Arthur, a way to completely rule out gluten sensitivity, and that's to look for the surface markers. And that test is for the HLA antigens associated with gluten disease, DQ2 and DQ8. And if you don't have either of those antigens in your system, you don't have and cannot get celiac disease, and you don't have gluten sensitivity narrowly defined. A person can still have intolerance to wheat without being specifically gluten sensitive, because there are other antigens on wheat that a person can become sensitized to. So it's complicated, and like most complicated things, that creates the basis for lovely debate and dialogue. Our second email question from Lynn in Santa Cruz this week. Lynn writes, on your show, can you discuss the new warning about asthma medications, especially Advair? My 20-year-old daughter is using it and has been advised to use it daily. Yes. Now, this is a new FDA safety control report. This just came out this week. And the FDA has announced that manufacturers of long-acting beta agonists must now state on their product labels that asthma patients should not take these on a long-term basis unless their condition cannot be adequately controlled with other medications such as inhaled corticosteroids. The labels must also state that the long-acting beta agonists should never be used alone in the treatment of asthma in adults or children. Now, this is a mandate from the FDA. This is old news scientifically. From a practical standpoint, I'm very sorry to see this come up because it is going to probably lead to more work for me. Now, let's go back to these long-acting beta agonists. The short-acting drugs are drugs like albuterol or Zofenex. Many of you may be taking a version of these drugs. These drugs act on the beta-2 receptor in the lung, and they are an agonist, that is to say that they stimulate the beta-2 receptor, like adrenaline would, and cause it to relax, opening up the lungs. And asthma is a disease where the circular muscles around the bronchioles go into spasm. So if you relax them, you open up the bronchioles. The problem with the short-acting beta dilators is that they're short-acting. So the short-acting beta agonists don't last very long, maybe 4 hours, and then you need to use them again. And the other problem is they're not completely specific, so they also stimulate beta receptors in the heart and speed up the heart rate. They can cause tremor. They can cause a person to feel jittery and nervous, so we don't like to use them all the time. And the third problem with these drugs is that the body develops resistance to them over time. So if you're using them very frequently, they work less and less well to open up the bronchioles. And since this is our go-to drug in a crisis, you don't want to use up your body's reaction to the go-to drug. People actually die of asthma if they can't be treated in a crisis situation. The long-acting beta agonists were very, very useful. They last 12 to 18 hours, and so one dose opens up those airways for a very, very long time. One of the things that happened, and this is a biological, psychological, cultural phenomenon, since drugs like Advair came out, which combine a steroid and a long-acting beta agonist, they've really taken over the asthma care market. That's because they're so much easier to get patients to use. Here's my take on that. When a person uses a inhaled steroid, there are a couple of issues involved. Issue number one is, it's a steroid. Everybody knows steroids are bad. Everybody knows steroids stunt your growth and suppress your adrenal glands and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you read the package insert, it says all of those things. Now, of course, there's caveats. It's all about the dose. It's all about how you deliver it. The use of steroids in children who are asthmatic does not stunt their growth. It does not cause adrenal suppression. And there's plenty of long-term studies that show very acceptable risks compared to not treating asthma. So, you know, risk-benefit, solidly on the side of using the steroids. Public perception, solidly against. This is a problem. So along comes Advair. And the nice thing about Advair and Symbicort and the other drugs, which are combined steroids and long-acting beta agonists, is that you get a reward structure going. Person comes in, they're feeling sick, they're not breathing well, I give them one blast of the Advair, the long-acting beta agonist makes them feel better. And over the course of 3 or 4 days after the steroid kicks in, they are now controlled, doing well with their asthma, not needing a rescue inhaler, and very happy. And from my standpoint, most importantly, going to keep taking the drug. Now, keep taking the drug is really huge in asthma. And remember what I said about the public perception of steroids. So having a little reward thing that people noticed if they stopped taking it after about a week, their symptoms came back, they start taking it again, their symptoms go away, go through a few cycles of that, and the person is kind of psychologically wedded to using their medication appropriately. And that's a good thing. The problem is, after a week on the steroids, they probably don't need the long-acting beta agonist any longer and could be switched over to just a steroid, which if they kept using it, would be just fine. But the problem is, So human nature being what it is, people generally fall off the wagon. So like I said, I can easily see a strategy for dealing with this new FDA mandate and also with the public perception. I'm going to have to give people a week of Advair and then switch them over to just the steroid ingredient in the Advair without the long-acting beta agonist and make it clear from the get-go that you start with this and then you move to this and this maintains you out of trouble. And then if you start to get into trouble again, you pull out your albuterol and you give me a call and we decide whether or not you're going to go back on the Advair for a week or two until you get control over your asthma again. That will, in the long run, be more work and safer for the patients. I guess I'll just have to put up with that, given the fact that I am supposed to be taking care of the patient's best interest. Maybe I'll just deal. And we're going to Hillary in Boulder Creek. Hello, Hillary, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, how can I help?
About 3 weeks ago, the end of January, I had a fall and initially thought just a minor trauma. And my skin has healed, but next to the left of the cut, I developed a large level of swelling on my calf. I thought it looked like cellulitis. My doctor said, saw it and prescribed antibiotics.
Which one?
And I've been on a full course of Keflex, a Keflex shot that's supposed to last for a week, a full course of Augmentin, and a full course of doxycycline, and this thing is still here. And she thought it was 11 years ago I had a gouty attack, and since then have been controlling my gout with diet and stuff like that. And I had a couple of big toe sore incidents, but...
Okay, it seems like we're drifting off topic here on the gout. Did she think that this could be a gout attack?
Yeah, and I wondered if maybe gout can be inspired by physical trauma.
Well, gout is only ever going to occur in a joint, and you're saying your calf, so I'm having trouble with it being gout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mechanism of gout is that the crystals of uric acid come out of solution and crystallize in the joint, and then the macrophages go after those crystals as if they were a foreign body, and you get a massive foreign body inflammation reaction. So I'm wondering, running the differential in my head, what about a phlebitis? Because you had a blow or an injury. Could you have injured a vein and you have now an infection or an inflammation in the vein? And those don't necessarily respond to antibiotics, particularly the antibiotics we use for skin infections. So yeah. I would consider the possibility of phlebitis, and the fact that you've been on all of these things and not gotten any improvement certainly suggests that either you're dealing with a very seriously drug-resistant organism, or you've got a different diagnosis and it's not what it appears to be, but something else. You said you've been on all these antibiotics. I hope you've been taking probiots because you're really at risk.
Yeah, lots of yogurt, lots
Good.
Of vitamin C.
Good, because you're really at risk for complications from the antibiotics at this point. It might be time to seek a second opinion, possibly from an infectious disease doctor. It's very difficult to diagnose things over the radio, and of course I don't, you know, I'm not in the business of diagnosing things anyway because this is not a therapeutic relationship, but I'd say it's time for a second opinion.
Oh, thank you. And do you see it as something like go to the ER like today or just...
Well, how long have you had it and is it getting worse?
Sort of, it goes up and down. In the morning it's better and then as my leg is down it gets
bigger and worse.
And I've had it since like around January 29th.
Okay. I really think this might be a phlebitis. What you just said about it getting worse when you're up on your feet would certainly be consistent with that.
Uh-huh.
Probably either a vascular person, like a vascular surgeon, or an infectious disease person. Do you need to get a referral from your primary? That will depend on your insurance. If you go to the emergency room, first of all, it doesn't sound like an emergency given the duration of time. I don't think you'll get necessarily the best treatment. I do think just getting a medical second opinion and asking the question so that the doctor's mindset is, could this be phlebitis, would be a good strategy. Write down everything that you've taken, when you started it, when you stopped it, when the blow occurred, kind of do a little chronology so that when you go in, the doctor has a thorough history.
Great.
And then good luck.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. And just a word about the second opinion. A professional means that you don't take things personally. And as a doctor, when someone gets a second opinion, I work not to take that personally. For one thing, I know that sometimes I don't see the obvious. And when another doctor starts from the beginning and gets a slightly different spin on the story, they can often find an answer that's eluded me despite my best efforts. And I'm always grateful when the patient gets better. I don't necessarily need to be the one to do it in order to feel good when my patient improves. It's not a nya-nya, I got a second opinion kind of thing, and I think most of us as professionals don't take it that way. A fresh pair of eyes looking at a situation can often see the solution, just like when you lose your car keys and your husband or wife walks in and says, "There they are, honey." That's exactly the situation. There it is. Why didn't I see it? Oh, well, I didn't, and somebody else did. At least the patient gets better. Let's go to Manuela in Boulder Creek. Hello, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. This has to do with about the asthma.
Okay.
Medication. Albuterol is also Ventolin. Is that correct?
Yes.
Albuterol sulfate?
Yes.
Okay. And then Salomol?
Salbutamol?
Yes, salbutamol sulfate. Is that also the albuterol?
No, that's different.
Okay. And the other name, is this fluticasone?
Fluticasone, yes. That's an inhaled steroid. So what we've got here is, sounds like standard asthma therapy.
Which is a Ventolin?
Let's try to use the generic names just for clarity.
Albuterol.
Yeah, let's use the generic names because I can get confused bouncing back and forth, and I want to be sure I put good information out here. So albuterol is a rapid-acting beta agonist. Salbutamol is a long-acting beta agonist. And fluticasone is the inhaled steroid. So the ideal circumstance is that when a person is in a flare, they use a long-acting beta agonist and the steroid, and then as soon as their asthma flare is controlled, they switch over to just the steroid version, the fluticasone, and stay on that. The analogy is, think about the brush fires that we sometimes have in California, all right? If it's late August and there hasn't been rain for 6 months and there's fields as dry as tinder, then brush fires can get started. When a fire is going, you use water on that fire and fire retardant, and you try to get the fire put out. But then once the fire is out, you don't stop there. You do things like cutting the grass down, trying to prevent, you're eliminating the fuel, to prevent a future fire, or using a suppressant agent of some kind. So you can really think of the steroid as the suppressor. It's a prevention. It keeps the fire from getting started, just like cutting the grass keeps the fire from being able to get started and build. The albuterol and the salbutamol, as far as that are concerned, are both water and the sort of things they spray out of the helicopters, the fire retardants. You're trying to put the fire out. But once the crisis is over, you go back to the prevention piece, and that's where the steroids come in.
And the name of the steroid is?
The fluticasone.
Fluticasone.
All right. And there are other steroids, but that's a whole class of drugs. Fluticasone is one member of that class.
Okay, and then that's the steroid, and then the long-acting, beta agonist?
That's the salbutamol.
Okay.
So ideally what we want to do with you, and you need to do this with your doctor, okay? You know, children, don't try this at home. This requires some finesse and some serious experience, and it also requires that the patient actually use their medications.
Yeah.
Because you want to avoid the long-acting beta agonists on a long-term basis because they can affect your heart. And in a few minutes, we'll go to the science lesson, and I'll explain one of the ways that these drugs do affect your heart. Okay?
Yes.
All right. I'm glad that you called.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And let's take one more call before we do that science lesson, and that's Robert in Aptos. Hello, Robert. Welcome
to
the program. Hi.
I have a quick question about the use of chlortrimazole, a topical antifungal.
Go ahead.
I've been using it for about a year and still haven't been able to get rid of the fungal situation, and I just wonder about safety and also if there's any other type of product that's safer to use or more effective to use.
I'm sorry, I missed the name of the topical antifungal you're using.
Chlortrimazole.
Okay. This is long-term use, and that's
over a year.
Over a year. There's no corticosteroid mixed into the chlortrimazole. This is like the over-the-counter, off-the-shelf stuff?
No, as far as I know, there isn't.
All right. Some of the prescription versions of antifungals also have steroids built into them, and I really discourage those for long-term use.
Yeah.
If you're buying it over-the-counter, it will not be one of those. The use of these agents is generally accepted as safe, which means they've been around for a long time, and we aren't seeing systemic effects or breakdowns in terms of liver damage or stressing the detoxification systems of the body. This is in contradistinction to oral antifungals, which do have the potential for causing liver damage and do need to be monitored very carefully.
I see.
Okay, so when you take them topically, you don't absorb much. They tend to stay in the skin, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But why long-term antifungals raises a question in my mind, because that's like continually using a weed killer. Why don't we eliminate the weeds? And so some other things that might be useful for you would be something like selenium shampoo. Selsun Blue is a brand name. And using that as a body wash a couple of times a week.
All right.
Leaves a little residue of selenium on the skin, quite non-toxic. And then the fungus never really gets started. And you can keep it from starting. Again, why not cut the grass rather than wait for the grass fire? So I would try that. And I don't think long-term use is a problem, but I'd rather see you using it in bursts when the fungus overgrows the preventative rather than using it all the time. And eventually the fungus will become resistant and you don't want to go there.
Oh, that's what I was worried about. All right, I'll try that. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now we're going to go to that science lesson I promised you. And this was prompted both by the story that I referred to earlier around the FDA's requirement for long-acting bronchodilators to be labeled, but also because of another story, this one coming out last year, and I'm just kind of coming around to it. I keep these science lessons and think about how I'm going to do them. And this was a research project that was published last year in Nature Genetics, looking at the common genetic variants that are a risk factor for sudden cardiac death. And these researchers looked at genetic data from more than 13,000 people, and then they looked at which of those people had a sudden death event, and then they looked for genetic variants. And they came up with 14 common variants, which are located on 10 different gene regions that all affect the QT interval. Now, we're going to talk about the QT interval because it's extremely important in pharmacology. And now that we actually have identified the genetic loci for it, it's, I think, a wonderful idea to start screening people for this DNA and develop a quick test, because we kill people every year with drugs. I'm sure you've heard the figures, 40,000 deaths minimum every year from prescription drugs used properly. Not overdoses, not mistakes, just bad reactions to good drugs. And we'd really like to see that number go down. And one of the ways that we're going to do that is by recognizing that not everybody is exactly the same. There's lots of genetic variations. And some of those genetic variations are like unexploded mines waiting to be stepped on, and we'd rather not step there. How do we know where the minefield is? Well, genetic testing is going to tell us. Now, in the case of the QT interval, I want you to visualize the heart. We can all sort of have the image of the four chambers of the heart in our head as I talk about this. And on the right heart, which is the top part, the right atrium, there is a little thing called the SA node. And this is your heart pacemaker. It is important to understand that every single cell in your heart, every single heart muscle cell, is also kind of a nerve cell. Every heart muscle cell is capable of generating a action potential and actually creating a nerve impulse or an electric impulse that will propagate across the heart. The node, the SA node, which is your pacemaker, does that 60 to 100 beats per minute, and that creates a spark, just like a spark plug. This propagates across the atrium, and if it propagates properly, you get a nice steady contraction of the atrium, which pushes blood from the upper chambers of the heart into the lower chambers. At the point that this impulse reaches the top of the ventricle, the top center of the heart, kind of the four corners region, if you will, where the upper chambers and the lower chambers meet, there's something called the AV node. And the AV node is a filter. It's not capable of generating a speed much above 180. And that's what keeps our hearts from going crazy and beating themselves to death, literally shaking themselves to death, if we have atrial fibrillation. Now, in atrial fibrillation, the upper ventricle isn't firing. The SA node isn't working properly. It's being overridden by a bunch of impulses. It's as if everybody in the room were shouting. You can't hear anything, and no coherent signal gets to the AV node. A lot of noise does, and the AV node passes that through. When it's running at a low speed, you've got atrial fibrillation and you feel okay. When it's running at a fast speed, that's called atrial fibrillation with a rapid response or a rapid ventricular response. That puts you in the hospital while we treat you with drugs that improve the filtering of the AV node. Now, what happens if the whole right atrium is gone, not generating any signal? Well, the AV node itself will generate a signal. But while the pacemaker is working at 60 to 100, the AV node can only really fire maximally at about 45 to 60. So people who have this problem, they've lost their pacemaker and their heart is working off the AV node, will have a slow conduction. They'll have a slow ventricular rate. And what you will see in these people is that they'll faint, they'll have trouble with standing up without passing out, and they end up with pacemakers, artificial pacemakers, which have been a huge boon in cardiology. Now, from the AV node, the conduction passes through the middle of the heart between the two ventricles, and it spreads out in a very orderly fashion. It's rooted quickly down to the bottom of the heart, and then the fibers spread out in a spiral. This allows the heart to contract, and the ventricles actually twist, just like wringing out a washcloth. You're wringing the blood out of the heart and squirting it through the aorta and through the pulmonary artery every heartbeat. Now, electrically, after the ventricle contracts, it has to relax, and all of the little capacitors need to be reset. Now, we all know what a capacitor is, whether we know it or not, because everybody has, by now, a camera that has a little flash on it. And if you've tried to take a lot of photos in rapid succession, you've noticed that you can't do that with the flash, that you have to wait for the capacitor to recharge. And that's exactly what happens in the heart. You have these capacitors, which have a different recharge time. That's basically the cell itself. So the cells in the SA node have the fastest recharge time, and that's where they're usually the pacemaker. The AV node, the next fastest. And the ventricular cells, while they're capable, if they don't receive a signal, of generating their own beat, will do it at a rate of about 30 to 40. So a person who is running off of a ventricle is really in trouble. Now, I mentioned that atrial fibrillation is when everybody in the room starts shouting. All of the cells are contracting independently of each other, and therefore there's no squeeze of the atria. It just sort of sits there and quivers. Well, that's fine for the atria. That only really gives us 15% of our heart rate. But if you lose the ventricle, well, then you've lost everything, and you're not moving blood, and that's called a cardiac arrest. So ventricular fibrillation is when all of the ventricle cells start shouting all at the same time. Now there's no coordinated beat, there's no squeeze, and the blood doesn't leave the heart. Well, that's a non-sustainable situation, and you lose consciousness in 10 seconds, and you've sustained irreversible brain damage between 3 to 5 minutes. That's why we call it sudden death. Now, it's key during the heartbeat that the ventricular cells recharge completely and are all coordinated, and all of the capacitors have gotten refilled, recharged again, before the next beat comes along. That's dependent on something called the QT interval. And if you look at an EKG, if you visualize that EKG tracing, there are three mountains. There's a small little mountain, then there's a pause, then there's a valley, and a big peak mountain, and another valley, and another pause, and then there's a third mountain. That third mountain is the actual recharging of the capacitor. And so if the heartbeat starts, if the next impulse arrives at the ventricle before that capacitor, all of them are fully recharged, then the ones that have recharged will fire, and the ones that haven't can't fire. And as a result, they get out of sync. Then at that point, it slams into ventricular fibrillation, and you've got your 3 to 5 minutes to get the heart rate back and start pumping blood. Now, there are a lot of drugs that prolong the QT interval, a lot. And this congenital QT problem that I'm talking about, that they have identified the genes for, is fairly common in the population. Now, albuterol, Zofinex, all of the rapidly acting bronchodilators, the beta-2 agonists that we talked about in the asthma story, all of those drugs should be avoided in people with congenital QT slowing. All of the diet drugs, all of the ADD drugs, all of the over-the-counter weight loss drugs, and most of the over-the-counter cold meds. And just for fun, if you've managed to get that far through life and gotten into your senior years, most of the bladder incontinence drugs can prolong the QT interval. And that's not even talking about some of the antidepressants and some of the antipsychotics and a host of other agents which can interact in some individuals. But those are the big ones. Now, those are drugs I prescribe all the time. Those are drugs that are also available over the counter. Yet, many people will be taking a risk, a significant risk, by using them. Now, again, it's risk-benefit. If you've got severe asthma and you're going to suffocate, and there's a small probability that the asthma drug is going to throw you into this ventricular fibrillation, you use the asthma drug, but going to try to minimize the use of that. And that's a person you're really going to lean on for the inhaled steroids. And that's a person you might even give oral steroids to preferentially. And you'll use a different approach therapeutically in that person. So every now and then I stop and I think about, what's my wish list before I retire, what I'd like to see medicine look like. And you have some understanding of that if you're a regular listener. I'd like everyone to have access to decent health care. I think that's a primary goal. But what we really need for 21st century medicine, what we really need to make all of the work and money that's gone into the Human Genome Project really pay off therapeutically, is we need to identify genetic variants like these 14 genes that influence the QT interval. And we need, at birth or shortly thereafter, to do universal screening for everyone and create a database profiling these genetic variants and connecting it to death and complication data so that we can identify more problems. This is so, so doable. I mean, our lives are all up there on the web, and we have kind of reinvented the notion of privacy, I think, for the next generation. They certainly have. And maybe we need to have a universal database and really solid anti-discrimination laws. Yes, I know there is an anti-discrimination law for genetic information. I'm just not sure that it's going to be enforced. And, you know, I don't trust the health plans not to use that information to discriminate. So I want to see that actually solidly prevented rather than just wait for the case to occur and then go to the Supreme Court in 5 years. Ideally, in the ideal world, everyone would have a genetic profile. And when I prescribed a drug, there would be an automatic scan, which would alert me that there might be a problem. And more important than that, suggest a viable alternative. So, do you really need to give this drug? There is a risk. You could use this drug. There wouldn't be a risk there. Rethink your therapeutic strategy, doctor, or at least talk to the patient and make sure they understand how to minimize their risk from using this agent, what not to mix it with, for example. Don't take albuterol and Sudafed if you have this genetic mutation. Don't ever use Dexatrim. Those are the kinds of bits of advice I'd like to be able to offer to my patients to help keep them safe and to minimize those unnecessary deaths from necessary medications. Let's go now to Liliana in Pacific Grove. Hello, Liliana. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Ah, baby in the background.
Okay. Oh, I have to walk outside. My question is, so yesterday my husband watched our friend make chicken, which we ate last night for dinner, and she didn't rinse it. And this morning he's got pretty bad diarrhea. I don't yet, and I'm wondering whether I should breastfeed my baby in case I get the diarrhea, if it has to do with the chicken, if the bacteria passes on through the breast milk.
Okay, good question. No, you don't have to worry about salmonella coming in through the breast milk. And make sure your hands are really clean. What I would worry about is a toxin, you know, salmonella being the common one that's seen in chicken. But, but there are other possibilities as well. So when a person gets sick that quickly, it's usually a toxin-related illness rather than a bacterial infection, but not always.
Okay.
And then there's always viruses, and then there's always, you know, baby in diapers. The parents can pick up bacteria and viruses from the baby. So lots of possibilities there. But bottom line, he's sick. He needs to be scrupulous about his hand washing. I would be very, very careful to wash my hands before I touch my child, because you may pick up bacteria on the doorknob or on the refrigerator
right.
handle if he has a little bit under a fingernail that he doesn't get. It can really get on surfaces, and we don't want it getting onto your nipples or into
right.
your baby's mouth. But it's not coming through your bloodstream into your breast milk, into your baby's mouth. And the toxins that we associate with diarrhea, with the exception of the E. coli omega, which I'm not certain couldn't get into breast milk. I don't know if it does or doesn't. But the other ones are not a risk for you.
Okay.
Just lots and lots of good hygiene.
Okay. And does it matter? And because I was saying, well, chicken's cooked, so it doesn't matter. But in terms of rinsing the chicken before you cook it, is that necessary?
Well, I generally rinse and pat dry chicken, but I understand that by doing that, I'm reducing the bacteria count. And I think okay. if you're buying like a whole fryer or something, it depends a lot on how the chicken was processed, what the risk is that it's going to be contaminated. But because such a high percentage of the chicken we eat is processed in factories where it's sort of sitting in a broth of chicken poop at one point,
right.
and that can, of course, contaminate a whole rack of chickens, you know, hundreds maybe, and that bacteria will sit there and not really proliferate, but the toxins are there, and they're not heat labile. Some of them are heat stable, and so you can't always destroy toxins by cooking, not all of them.
Okay.
Bottom line is, people get foodborne illnesses all the time. In adults, they're generally self-limited and not severe. Lots and lots of fluid for your husband, and really careful hygiene because you have an infant in the house.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
And let's talk to Jerry in Cupertino. Hello, Jerry.
Morning.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. A couple of real quick questions. I somehow tweaked my back a couple of months ago. I think it deals with the sacroiliac joint. I still have an issue on the left side. And so when I, you know, when I lay down or, you know, to go to sleep, if I need to roll over, I just get pain. I think it wakes me up in the mornings or in the evenings when I'm trying to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Also, towards the end of the day, usually the day starts out fairly well, but towards the end of the day, I'll get shooting pains down my left leg, particularly if I walk or I carry things. You know, when I'm leaning over the sink to wash dishes at the end of the day, it starts to ache a bit.
Let me ask you to do something. You can stand up and bend backwards and
yeah.
tell me if that hurts.
Yeah, it has in the past.
Does it hurt now?
Not terribly bad, but it's, you know, there is a, there's an indication of, you know, pain on the left side.
Okay. That's my go-to test for sacroiliac as
yeah.
opposed to lumbago or low back pain. Because the
yeah.
leaning over the sink thing sounds more like muscular low or ligamentous low back pain of the flexion variety.
Mm-hmm.
And the sacroiliac typically is worse with leaning backwards and kind of relieved by leaning forwards a little bit.
Okay.
So you could have both. There's always that possibility.
Always a possibility.
Always that possibility.
Is
the pain,
something
in your leg does not go past the knee down the back of your thigh?
It kind of centers. It actually goes down the leg, and there are times that I think it goes all the way down to, you know, the calf.
If it goes to the calf, I worry a little bit about there being a nerve root problem, one of the nerve roots being pinched or squeezed.
Okay.
And that could be from a disc, that could be from arthritis, or it could be from the deep pelvic muscles, where sometimes the piriformis muscle, which is one of your deep butt muscles, will squeeze the nerve.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a sciatica component. Going into the calf is suggestive of that.
Okay.
So you had a question about how to properly take analgesics.
Right. So what I've been doing is in the evenings, you know, if I know that my back has been bothering me a bit, you know, and I've had some pain because I've been, you know, walking the dogs, that sort of thing, what I'll do is I'll take a couple of ibuprofen before I go to sleep. And the question I have is that, should I take ibuprofen during the day, or is it just for, you know, my back hurts, so I'll take it this evening, even though I'll still have symptoms during the day, but, you know, I'm awake during the day, so it's not a an issue that says, well, I can't fall asleep.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I have a problem with you taking ibuprofen at bedtime on an empty stomach, because I'm thinking that you are increasing your risk of having an ulcer or a gastrointestinal bleed by that strategy, not to mention giving yourself some reflux esophagitis, and then once you get the esophagus inflamed, it's weeks to get it back into normal conditions. So needlessly taking a risk there.
Okay.
All right. If you're going to do ibuprofen, I think it's much more appropriate to take it with food.
Okay.
You can take it for two reasons. You can take it as a painkiller, in which case a dose of 200 to 400 milligrams is sufficient, or you can take it as an anti-inflammatory, in which case you have to use about 600 to 800 milligrams two or three times a day to get to the threshold level that reduces inflammation. Back to that brush fire metaphor, you have to keep throwing water on the fire until the fire is well and truly out. And the firefighters will tell you that's days in the summertime, not just until you don't see smoke. And smoke for pain here in this metaphor. So one thought I have is, if this is a real chronic low back condition, you probably should get some physical therapy or get a good low back exercise book. Robin McKenzie's Treating Your Own Low Back is an excellent, venerable book. It's been around for 25 years. The exercises in that are superb.
Okay.
And you should be working on your deep pelvic muscles, your deep abdominal and core muscles, as they're called. And you should look, because of your symptoms, I would also look and see whether or not using a heel lift on the left side reduces your pain, because you may have a little bit of leg length asymmetry, which is tending to overwork your sacroiliac joint. Some people respond really well to chiropractic. I know I'm getting complaints lately because I'm being nice to chiropractors, so I'm getting flack on that from some of my emailers. And I'm going to set up, by the way, parenthetically, folks, I'm going to set up a debate here and talk to some pro and anti-chiropractic people and just put it all out there, but that's for another show. For this purpose, when a person has recurrent problems like you're describing, having their back manipulated for a sacroiliac, manipulated back into position, and seeing if that alleviates the discomfort. If it's going to work, by the way, it should work right away, and it should be helpful for several days minimum to be worth using chiropractic as a strategy.
Okay.
As if you meet those conditions, and when you flare it, you go and get a treatment, that can, with the combination of the exercises and the heel lift, if it's appropriate, make a big difference in the frequency of your pain. And I'd rather see you not be having to use analgesics, right?
Right, right. Okay.
Okay.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. And we had an off-air question, which I'll take while I'm waiting for my next caller. A 10-month-old grandson was given antibiotics for cough and now has eczema on the back of the knee. Is this related to antibiotics and how to treat this? There's a family history of eczema. Okay, this is a classic functional medicine problem, and I'm going to give you the functional medicine response. The functional medicine response is, yes, absolutely, there's a connection with the antibiotics and now the appearance of the eczema. And the theoretical basis for this connection goes something like this. People who have a family history of eczema or asthma or allergies are vulnerable to overamplification of a part of their immune system called the Th2 response. And when your Th2 is upregulated, you tend to get allergic to things. In children, that often shows up as food allergies. And eczema in an infant is almost always related to some food that the infant is commonly taking. Now, a 10-month-old might be on milk formula, they might be breastfed, they might be getting some wheat, they might be getting corn, and they're probably exposed to soy. And guess what? Those are the big ones. Cow's milk proteins, soy proteins, corn proteins, and wheat proteins are the ones that children most often show antibodies against. And often they'll outgrow those antibodies. But the problem is the antibiotics interfere with your gut flora, your gut bacteria, are very important in regulating the Th2 response. So when you take those guys down, the Th2 response goes crazy. Furthermore, the gut bacteria have been implicated in holding these proteins, these antigens, very similar to the HLA barcodes I was talking about with the celiac disease. Foods have their own barcodes. And if those antigens stay in the intestine, they're unlikely to connect with the antibodies, and then you don't get the skin rashes, because it's antigen, HLA barcode, plus antibody against that barcode circulating in the bloodstream and then fetching up in the skin, where it triggers an immune skin response, and that's the cognitive model for eczema. So treatment for this, probiotics can help reduce eczema. Strong placebo-controlled information about this. Go look up the article by Gary Huffnagel. That's June 9th, 2007 in the Ask Dr. Don archives. There's an excellent interview discussing the use of probiotics in pediatric eczema and asthma, and I strongly urge you take a look at that. Next caller is Heidi in Palo, Colorado Canyon.
Hi.
Hi.
I just got a call from my 87-year-old mother, and just to give you a very brief history here, she was born with bilateral congenital hips, and over the years she's had a series of surgeries, including she's had about five hip replacements, mm-hmm. and she walks with crutches. And, of course, she's been walking with crutches for years, and now she has severe shoulder pain. So she just went to somebody who wants to possibly do a shoulder replacement. So my question is...
Did you say she was 87?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I heard that right.
Yes, you heard that right. So, you know, at 87, they don't get enough information, and no one gave her any information. So I don't know what the x-rays showed. I don't know exactly what they replaced. Mm-hmm. And the other possibility is to just put her on pain medication.
Okay, so let's assume for the sake of argument that she has severe shoulder arthritis and impingement, and that's why this recommendation is being made, which is...
And impingement would be...
Would be where the rotator cuff has been damaged and they have
okay.
a tear or a partial tear, so they are getting weakness in the arm and having trouble lifting it. Now, the rotator cuff really won't interfere. If you could lose your rotator cuff entirely and you would still be able to walk with crutches...
Okay.
So that's why I'm making the assumption that there's also arthritis involved.
Okay.
Now,
severe pain.
Yes, but severe pain, and she's already disabled and she needs to be able to walk. We don't want her to lose the ability to walk. On the other hand, a shoulder joint replacement in an 87-year-old woman sounds a little crazy as the first place she would go to. Of course, that's what our system pays for. It pays for surgeries, so there's an economic incentive from the doctor's standpoint. I would worry about her risk of surgical mortality, of dying
right.
on the table, so to speak, or of getting
yeah.
a pneumonia or having a problem with that or having a difficult rehab. It all depends on the 87-year-old, so I can only speak in general terms. But I would want multiple opinions from people who were not economically affiliated. I would want to have seen that that patient had steroid injections into the shoulder. Because if she could get a steroid injection every 3 months and be pain-free enough to get by on her crutches, you could do that for a decade. And that
okay.
would be a much more appropriate conservative thing.
Okay.
But again, I don't know her specific clinical situation. I do know that when the first thing out of the doctor's mouth is surgery for a pain problem, you need to see at least three doctors before you have the surgery.
I'm trying to do this quickly, and I don't think this was exactly the first thing out of his mouth. She can't lift her arm hardly at all, and she's having elbow and wrist pain also.
Well, you're not going to fix that with a shoulder replacement.
Now, what exactly do they replace?
They replace the ball and socket joint of the shoulder.
Okay. All right.
And it's relatively new treatment, and I think that maybe there's an incentive to do it because they get to do... the case. It's a new treatment, which means they're eager to do it so they can get practice.
And how long is she under the anesthetic, generally speaking, for this?
I haven't really a clear idea of that. At least a couple of hours. And it's not
okay.
necessarily the duration. It's the fact of doing any time you intubate and ventilate an elder, they're at risk for pneumonia, they're at risk for aspiration, and they're at risk for cardiac complications during the procedure. And they better need the procedure. And you better have exhausted conventional modalities first.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So steroids would probably be the best bet here.
Well, I don't know. I can't make...
Yeah.
I don't know the clinical situation. I can say that, asked this hypothetically, I wouldn't support in a patient of mine. I would be doing the shoulder injections every 3 months with long-acting lidocaine and steroids and having that fail. And I'd be using narcotics and having that fail before I went to surgery.
And narcotics, how often? Because she's adverse. She doesn't like to take medication. She takes one at night. That helps.
You know, I'm going to have to take the fifth on that because we really don't have time to cover that topic well, and I'm not going to try to do that in a minute.
Okay.
There's plenty of information about that out there, though.
All right.
Okay, and you can call back next week if you want.
Okay, maybe I will. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I want to thank you very much for listening. I hope you will make use of that resource that we're building in the archives, and this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.